Robert Morningstar is an investigative journalist and psychotherapist. He had his first contact experience over 70 years ago when he was only 3 years old. He's been writing about UFOs, extraterrestrial life, and the state of the world for decades. He was an editor and writer and publisher for UFO Digest, and today he has his own Substack article website.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Well, welcome, Robert, to Exopolitics Today.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I really am fascinated by your history. It really is quite a fascinating history in terms of your experiences as a child and what has happened over the subsequent decades. So why don't you take us back to the beginning? You know, what was your first contact experience? What happened? How old were you?
I was 3.5 years old, and I was sitting on the porch of my grandfather's home. It was nighttime, and some older boys were telling stories. There was a window into a room that was in darkness right next to me. And the opposite side of the room was a doorway that was open, and the hallway light was illuminating the room partially from behind, so it was backlit. So something caught my eye, peripheral vision. I saw something that was dark, black within the black, I would call it, in the darkened room. So you can imagine a darkened room with a door that's fully illuminated. And I saw something moving in the darkness, and it took my attention away. And I looked at it, and it walked across and stopped, right silhouetted, right in the doorway. And it kind of looked like it was skulking first, sneaking in, and then it looked right at me like this, and I went into panic. I thought that I was seeing the devil himself, and I started screaming bloody murder. And my parents, my grandfather ran out, my mother, and my grandmother, and like, wow, what's going on? There's something in the room. I saw it. It walked on when I looked, and I went into shock and screamed. It walked on, and again, black within the black, and they ran into the room immediately, you know, less than 30 seconds. They ran in there and they said, there's nothing in here. And I said to myself, imagine the logic, intuition of a 3.5 year old child. It must be under the house. That's what I said to myself. It went down under the house and through the floor. And that was a very shocking experience, which parallels, as I mentioned earlier, several other people that I know who had such a trauma. Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, has told me personally about his encounter. He was 3.5 years old, 4 years old, in Texas, when an alien walked in and tried to convince him that it was just a friendly clown. And I have other friends, some contactees and some who think that they are actually aliens in human bodies who were programmed, I would call it, you know, when they were 5 and 6 years old, and the little grays came and played with them as playmates. You know, they take a different approach with a lot of different people depending on the disposition.
Was this being a gray, or you mentioned something black on black and it disappeared?
Yeah, I would not call it a gray. I would not call it a gray. I would call it, to be quite frankly, after all of these many decades, I would call it a chupacabra, because it had the appearance, the silhouette. Chupacabra has spikes on its head. And so that's what I would call it. And I consider the chupacabra to be an alien hunting dog, you might say, something that is sent by an overlord, and I've had personal experiences with that thing.
Right. So this thing in your room, it just kind of appeared. It didn't actually interact with you. It just appeared and scared the
other than looking at me. and it was in the room, was the window was here, the room was there, it was in the room looking at me, and that was enough to terrify me.
Now, some people might say, well, that was some kind of demon as opposed to an extraterrestrial.
Well, they're all extraterrestrials, you know, demons, angels, ghosts. There's my book. They are all ex-Terrans. They are not of this world. Mm-hmm. So
have you had any other similar contact experiences over the years?
Yes, I have had many. I have had... the most amazing one was my encounter with the praying mantids in 1996. That happened in a very unusual way. It was triggered by my psychic abilities. You know, as I said before the show, that psychism and the paranormal are very important in this field. So I chose the path of parapsychology. I went to college at Fordham University and got my degree in psychology and have pursued a lifelong interest in development, self-development program in parapsychology. So this ability manifests itself in unusual ways. And in 1996, Richard Hoagland called me up. He was living in New Jersey, in Hoboken. And he said, Robert, you've got to get on to your computer and go to the GOES satellite, the NRL, Naval Research Laboratories, has just captured a UFO on a weather satellite. It's parked off the coast of California, off Monterey. The image is there. Go and grab it before they take it off. He said, one of my friends just called me to tell me about it. So I raced to the computer and I found the GOES West satellite. That's the weather satellite that was originally run by NRL. And I captured the frame. And for the next 16 hours, I worked on enhancing that image to see what it was. It ultimately, after 16, 17 hours of computer graphics, enlargement, enhancement, improvement, sharpening, I got it. And it was a cigar-shaped UFO that had a rolling door that would roll up like a roll-top desk and reveal a platform for deploying the scout ships. And I was very satisfied with it. I said, holy mackerel. So that when the roll top, it would imagine like a pie and you cut out one quarter of it. If you saw it from a front view or a side view, the whole quarter was section was out. In our aircraft carriers, we have the landing deck and we have the conning tower. But in this craft, the whole side was a wall where the hangars were, and the whole platform was what you would call the runway for deployment. And I was very happy with it and satisfied with the work. I lay back in bed and I did a meditation, which I learned from the Grand Master, Professor Cheng Manqing, Taoist Master of Tai Chi Chuan, and something that I do regularly in going to sleep. I started doing deep breathing into my lower abdomen, my Dantian. And after about 2 minutes, a sudden flash of blue light came out of my heart chakra, and it was flickering like a candlelight, but it was a very brilliant blue light, and it illuminated the room, which was actually partially illuminated by a street lamp, the third story building that is just as high as my window. So I'm never in complete darkness. This lamp is illuminating my room partially. And I saw 9 figures standing along the wall. They were very dark, very large figures. And when the light came on and I saw them, and I knew they were there, they all jumped at once. And they all said, he sees us. And I thought, yeah, I see you. And in that instant, from 15 feet away, maybe 15, 12 feet away, where depending on their position at the corners and the walls, they just instantly, they were hovering over my bed, and there were 9 of them, 3 on my left, 3 at the foot of my bed, and 3 on my right side. And the one closest to me, whom I call the leader, was just this far away. And you know, you see the size of my hand? That was the size of his eye. And he's staring at me, and he said to me, and I'm going to imitate the voice, you see us, but you are not afraid. And I said, yeah, I can handle your form. I've grown up with insects, water bugs, mantids. I can handle your form. And he turned to the others and he said, he sees us and he is not afraid. He can handle our form. So he hummed and they all hummed back in the same manner. And then he turned back to me and he said to me, do you think your people and my people can live, learn to live with one another? And I instantly said to him, yes, as long as we agree not to eat each other. That was a gut instinct, you know? That wasn't a premeditated answer. It was my gut reaction. Yes, we can learn to live together if we agree not to eat each other. So he turns to the others and he says, he thinks his people and our people can learn to live together as long as we do not eat each other. Now, while he turned at that moment to face them, I looked down my body and I saw the most incredible thing that you can imagine. As I said, there were nine of them. He was talking to me and the other eight were leaning over my body with their antennas, and their antennas were all wiggling like this, and they were intersecting but not touching, and they were scanning my body about 2 inches above the surface of my skin. And I was mind boggled at the intelligence of these creatures, because I was a fencer in college, and you know, I know foil, epee, saber. Imagine 16 fencers all waving their foils frantically and not a single one touching or clashing. And I was struck, awestruck by the sensitivity and the incredible intelligence that I felt amongst them.
So, now with these praying mantis, did you get a sense that they were from the inner earth or from off planet? Were they extraterrestrial or inner earthers?
I believe they were off planet because they came down to see me because of my concentration for 16 hours on that image, the satellite image. See, chi is electromagnetic and it's bimodal. It travels simultaneously in two directions. So when I was scanning their ship through the satellite image, my concentration and my chi was going as like an uplink and going to their ship. And I think they said, hey, who is this? Who's this guy looking at us? And they got curious. And that's why they came down. And this story has happened before to other remote viewers that, for example, a group of remote viewers, two of them decided to dive into the Dulce complex. They decided to spy on the Dulce underground base and try to get into the seventh level. They descended into the seventh level and they saw the horrors of the Hall of Hell. And they felt that they were in the realm of Lucifer. Then all of a sudden they felt as if they had been seen and they departed, but then they were followed. So this psychic energy, it's not limited by time and space. And it's not limited by your preconceived ideas of what it is or what it isn't. So that's what I feel happened. But there's another thing that I'll tell you, which is very important, is that when he turned to tell them about my statement, yes, we can learn to live with one another as long as we do not eat each other. When he turned and I saw the intelligence, I had another gut instinct that came up. And it said, Robert, don't trust these guys. They don't know the meaning of trust. They don't know the meaning of loyalty. They don't know the meaning of keeping an agreement. They're out only for themselves. And that's how I feel about it. I don't trust extraterrestrials.
Okay.
We are terrestrial. This is our planet. They don't belong here.
Okay. Now, you became aware of having some developed psychic abilities. You already mentioned your high level of concentration and focus. So when did you realize that you had these psychic abilities and they were unusual?
I knew that all my life, and my whole family had these abilities. You know, so I'm talking, let's say up to the age of 10, when I found out that the word parapsychology was what defined what this faculty was. I can remember, again, this would be 1958, I was 10 years old, and I remember being in a deep sleep, and I was hearing the Colonel Bogey March, every note, every whistle of the Colonel Bogey March from the bridge on the River Kwai. And then I woke up, and I could hear it in my mind still coming out of this dream state. And my uncle went over and turned on the radio, and the song, Measure for Measure, Beat for Beat, was what I was hearing. And I then also learned that I would know what would be on the TV screen a couple of seconds before it appeared. I had premonitory dreams. Again, this is when my awakening was beginning. Same year, 1958, I had a dream that I was watching a television newscast, and the announcer was either Walter Cronkite or Robert Trout, said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we're pleased to announce the discovery of the wreck of Titanic on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, 600 miles from Ireland." And it was so vivid. It was so vivid that it really came true when Bob Ballard found the Titanic. So that was a premonitory dream that I had 25 years before the actual event. So because of those abilities, telepathy is another ability. You know, I had this ability not just to hear other people's thought, but to answer their questions before they ask them. And so my curiosity was spurred. So I read everything about Edgar Cayce. I read everything that Hans Holzer wrote about ghosts. As a matter of fact, I keep his book right here. And ghosts have been a big part of my life as well. So I often say to people, necromancer and necromancy are ugly words for a very beautiful thing, the ability to communicate with the dearly departed, and sometimes not so dearly departed, for important reasons, is another part of this realm. So
okay, so you,
that's why I got into Fordham University and got involved in psychology. And a little later I'll tell you about my fellowship with the U.S. Navy program to develop artificial intelligence.
Okay.
Well, which I believe.
We'll get into that. So I know there was also, you had a vision quest with the Lakota Sioux, and they initiated you into their tribe. And that's how the name Morningstar comes in. So you want to explain all?
Yes. I anglicized my family name that I have, Morgenstern. I'm a descendant of Morgan Stearns, and I anglicized it to Morningstar because I am 20% Native American, and I am, I'm like the United Nations. I have so many bloodlines flowing through me from that I facetiously describe myself as a Greco-Roman, Slavic, Mayan, Celtic Jew, Celtic Gaul as well. I have 15% Scottish and Irish. I have German blood. I have French and Spanish blood. Europe, the bloodlines of Europe are amalgamated in my bloodstream. So I like to call myself an unhyphenated American, because that hyphen is what was intentionally put there to split the cohesion of American identity. You know, that came out in around 1964 after Lyndon Johnson took office. And they found a very easy way to factionalize the electorate by putting the ethnicity first. For example, African-American or Italian-American, Jewish-American, putting the ethnicity first separates you from the public. And I'm also very well aware of how communist jargon, communist newspeak was infused into our language. And I find people unwittingly using it all the time. For example, when they talk about the collective, the proletariat, and the masses, That's all communist, you know, jargon. So I say, I'm not a member of the collective. I'm a member of the union. I'm not a member of the masses. I'm a member of the public. I'm not a proletariat. I'm a citizen. So my insights go very deeply into how mind control has been used to fragment the United States of America with wedge issues, as they call them. So the upshot is that all of this body of knowledge, I have worked for many, many years to set our nation back on the right course. Because in 1990 in Switzerland, I had a remarkable psychic experience when I decided to fly the Matterhorn. I am a private pilot. I've been flying since 1984. I've flown all over the world in small aircraft. And I've had an airborne. The reason I became a pilot was to encounter UFOs in flight. And I had I've had that experience. But in 1990, I was in Switzerland, decided to fly the Matterhorn. And the night before I did that flight, I had an experience where I was in a cave, an ice cave, and there was an old, wizened old man sitting at a desk, and I went up to him, and he said, "Come, I am the angel of history. Let me show you what your people have done to your history." So he led me through an ice cave, and the ice cave was immense at the opening, but as we went through, it kind of got smaller and narrower. And we were going through this ice tunnel, and I looked on the left, and I saw in the ice the body of a very beautiful, blonde-haired, buxom woman. And I knew instantly that it was Marilyn Monroe. And as I looked, and then we kept going on, the angel of history, had the light, and it was illuminating the walls as we passed. And then I saw this very tall, handsome man in a blue suit, and he reminded me of Burt Lancaster or Kirk Douglas, another body in the ice, and then we went on. I know now that that was John F. Kennedy. So we went through the cave, it kept getting smaller and started winding. And at one point, I came to the point in the cave where my feet wanted to go to the right, but I was forced to go to the left because there was a giant boulder there. There was no throughway. But I've been in caves and I know how caves form, and my feet know how caves form. The floor of a cave feels and which way you should go or shouldn't go. So anyway, I had to go left. And the angel and I started crouching. And we got to a cul-de-sac, a dead end. And I looked and he said, see what your people have done with their history. They have led you to the end of mankind. You must go back and tell your people. So we backtracked through the cave. Then we came to that juncture where my feet had wanted to go to the right. And the boulder was there, but at that time I didn't touch the boulder, I just looked at it. This time I looked at it, I approached it and touched it, and the boulder was fake. The boulder was made out of paper mache and plaster and wooden beams, and I looked up and it was breaking apart at the ceiling, at the top. And I could have climbed up and gone through the crawl space, but I said to myself, I'm going to need a lot of help to tear this thing down. So he said, yes, go back, tell your people. So I backtracked through the cave. And when I got out of the cave, I was sitting in a theater. And in this theater were all the people of the world. Every continent was represented. One section was all the African nations. This other section, all South America. Our section were North Americans, Orientals, China. Everyone was in this theater watching this movie. And there were armed guards in the front with rifles, and they were watching to see, to make sure that everyone was watching the screen. So the screen parted and the film revealed the title, "The Film That Fooled the World." And I got it. Everyone on earth was being forced to watch this film, "The Film That Fooled the World," which was running incessantly 24/7 everywhere. And one man out of the corner of my eye took his eyes off the screen, and one of the guards raised his rifle and shot him in the head. Bang. He was gone. And I realized we're prisoners in this theater. We have to watch this movie, but I have to get out of here. So I said to my girlfriend who was in the dream with me, I was visiting her in Switzerland, said, "Barbara, take my hand and stand up. Keep looking at the screen." So we both stood up in the seats and looking at the screen. He said, "Barbara, walk sideways, but don't take your eyes off the screen. Walk into the aisle." So we shimmied across, walked into the aisles. The guards looked at us and they said, "Oh, they're still looking at the screen, so we don't have to shoot them." I said, "Barbara, stop, start walking backwards. Walk backwards. Don't take your eyes off the screen." We backed up through the doors and broke out into the vestibule of the theater. And we tried to get out. When I tried to get out, the doors were chained shut. So the whole world was locked up in this global theater, being forced to watch the film that fooled the world. So I ran around and found a stairway up to a second floor landing. And I threw open a window and there was a 50-foot drop into a torrential, raging river. And I said to her, we've got to jump. We've got to take this chance. We can't stay here prisoners in this theater. So take my hand. We jumped and we plunged. And when the dream ended, I was swimming up, pulling her up, swimming to the surface. And I could see the beauty of the sunlight shimmering on the surface of the water. And actually, it's quite similar to this vision that you have here near my mascot. That's what the last thing I saw. I broke out. I took a huge gasp of air. And I said, "What the hell is all that about?" And 2 years later, I found out. It was a premonition that I would discover the Zapruder film of the JFK assassination is a consciously engineered mass hallucination. It is the ultimate product of MK Ultra, the greatest example of mass mind control the world has ever seen, until they perfected Photoshop and videography to pull off 9/11. But
okay, back up a little bit, because I mean, you've already talked about your psychic abilities. You're having these kind of like vivid dreams. Now, at some point, you mentioned that the Office of Naval Intelligence became interested in you, and you became an intel asset. So, what happened there?
Okay, as I said, I've been pro Navy all my life since Sea Cadets, right? So. I feel, looking back in retrospect, that I was tagged in the Sea Cadets because, quite frankly, I was a bright light bulb, and they do these secret mentorship programs. They hand people off. But when I got into Fordham University and studying psychology, I was invited to be part of a program. It was a program in human learning. And it was to develop artificial intelligence. And my teacher, Professor John F. Walsh, who was also a Navy man, he had been a captain in the U.S. Marines and claimed to be a graduate of Annapolis, invited me and several others. He needed 18 students to do this study on artificial intelligence. Now, this is 1969. This is the first time I ever heard the word. And I said, "Professor, what is artificial intelligence?" And he said, "Well, Bob, that is teaching a computer how to think like a human being." And then he explained the program. He said, "I'm going to be measuring brain wave functions, brain voltages, and mapping neural networks for this project." And I said, "Professor, what are neural networks?" He said, "Well, Bob, all of your faculties, each of your faculties, temporospatial orientation, verbal skills, visual perception, reasoning, logic, all of these faculties are results of networks of neurons in your brain, which constitute that faculty. So what I'm going to do is map these neural networks, write them into a program. Then we're going to program a computer to think like a human being." And the offer was so enticing, I had to take it. The offer you couldn't refuse. No final paper. I mean, You don't have to write the final term paper. You don't have to take the final test, and other perks. Okay. So I agreed to do it. But when I got into the experiment, it was more than just a question and answers. They took a headband. The professor took a headband with six contact points, six electrodes, one here, two here. And this headband was connected to a box, and that box was connected to a computer. And from that computer, it was connected to a polygraph machine with six pens that were drawing the apparently six brain functions that the professor was measuring. So I believe that when they energized that headband, which I believe came from Roswell, personally speaking, I believe that this is the famous Roswell headband that had been disseminated, you know, for reverse engineering and applications. So I believe that when they connected me to this computer, the most advanced computer chip of the time, which was to be the computer chip in the F-14, the F-15, they had a very advanced computer chip. So IBM and the Navy and apparently the CIA was involved. So I believe that when that happened, that there was a transfer of my neural networks to the computer and the computer's circuitry to my head, or through the innervation of my brain with these six electrodes. Imagine these six electrodes putting an electric current in my brain and connecting faculties that are usually separate in each individual, right brain, left brain, right hemisphere, left hemisphere faculties, connecting them to each other, so that I developed a tremendous increase in IQ. When I was in high school, my IQ was measured at 131. And the last time I took an IQ, I had a 160 IQ and a 166 in geometry. So there's a movie called Forbidden Planet. And it is my belief that they got this idea from that movie, wherein one of the scientists connects himself to this alien intelligence machine and gets his brain boosted. So that was one of the, pardon the expression, one of the mishaps that happened in experimental psychology. But I'm quite satisfied with what it did for me, and I'm quite satisfied with what I've done with it to bring the truth of history to the American public. And the most important one being the death of John F. Kennedy and the relationship of UFOs to his assassination.
Okay, so in 1969, you're exposed to this experiment that is set up by the Office of Naval Intelligence, where your mind or your brain interfaces with some technology that is related in some way to a UFO crash retrieval, whether it's Roswell or something else, and that as a result of that, your mind could successfully interact with that, and you received a boost in IQ.
Okay. That's what it's called. It's called the Krell Brain Boost. So I joke that I got the Krell Brain Boost in Forbidden Planet. If you watch the movie, it's a brilliant film, way ahead of its time. And I think that scene, I think, affected a lot of brain researchers in trying to find that technology.
Well, I know in my research, what I've found is that a lot of people that have interactions with extraterrestrials or ET technology, their brain capacity increases, their psychic abilities increase, and that this is something that is very common. So that happened to you at that time. And so it sounds like the U.S. Navy or the Office of Naval Intelligence wanted to use you, and that's what you say, that you've been an intelligence asset for the Navy ever since.
Yes. On a subconscious level, that another part of it was, I guess, a program to make me an undercover secret operative, and secret even to myself, just doing it because this is what a good citizen does. But after 9/11 unfolded, that was a huge, huge shock, trauma, Those are real sounds of New York City, by the way. So you have to pardon it. That's called the sound of New York City news. So after 9/11, that caused a shock to me because as I tried to warn the government, about the impending attacks because I found these three of the three pilots that crashed on 9/11, they were training in New Jersey. And I ran into them between, 1999, the year 2000. They were training there, Muhammad Atta, Marwan al-Shehhi, and Hani Hanjour. And from August 9th through September 10th, I did my best to get the Immigration Service, the FBI in particular, and the FAA to investigate these people and pick them up and question them. But they didn't do it. And it's obvious now that they knew something was up, and actually I believe the government wanted it to happen so that they'd have an excuse for those the next set of Middle East wars.
Okay, so your psychic abilities gave you a kind of heads up on something dastardly being planned for New York City.
Yes. Yes. But it also guided me in directions, you know, where I would, for example, I wound up meeting Muhammad Atta in Hamburg in 1998 in a bar and almost coming to blows with the guy because he was the most hate-filled person I've ever met or seen in my life. But I have this knack with my research, for example, on the internet with a computer. So often my hand apparently accidentally will move mouse and click something or highlight something. And then I just say click. So I say, God moves the mouse, I just click it, because a lot of my discoveries happen in this fashion. It's purely intuitive. And intuition and instinct are two very important elements of the human psyche, the makeup of the human mind. But science has suppressed them over many, many years of time and has neutralized them. I look upon human beings today as having suffered the same operations that HAL 9000 had to suffer in 2001. The disconnection process where it'd become lethal to the astronauts. So people's memories have been shut down. They can't remember things. People's abilities to reason, all of these have been sabotaged in a lot of human beings, and primarily through mind control. So what I do is I break mind control, whether it's government mind control or alien mind control, memory suppression, things like that.
In as far as the Navy's concerned, I wanted to bring up this very interesting case that actually I was involved in as well with you and with concerning this U.S. Navy lieutenant commander who was attending these secret meetings at the United Nations in 2008 that were designed to bring about disclosure. So you wanted to tell us about your involvement with that case and Richard Tillman, the Navy commander, and what happened?
Absolutely. You and I have some mutual friends, Clay and Sean Pickering, and all of us are very involved in ufology. I met Clay and Sean at the UFO conference that was held here in New York, where they spoke about the manual, SOM-01, which is a official U.S. Department of Defense manual for recovery of alien craft and alien bodies, and they had the copy. So that's how we met. Then they called me in and told me about this initiative that was being sponsored by the U.S. Navy. And it was because for the first time in the history of the Department of Defense, three Navy admirals had ascended to the three top positions in the military. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Director of National Intelligence, and commander in chief or commander of the Central Command. That was Admiral William Fallon, Admiral Mike McDonald, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was Admiral Mike McCormick, something like that. So anyway, these three admirals got it together, and since this had been the purpose, as far as UFOs, the Navy has always wanted to tell the people the truth about UFOs. Secretary Forrestal was a Navy man. He was Under Secretary of the Navy before he became Secretary of Defense. And he was adamant that the people should know. So these three admirals said, look, you know, we have really big roadblocks within the U.S. government, the deep state, the CIA, the Air Force, and the Army. They won't let anything move, but maybe we can do it through the United Nations. So let's start an initiative to go to the United Nations and petition disclosure through the UN. So this is where Richard Thielman was assigned to the task. So I was introduced to Thielman, and he briefed me on what the plan was, and he told me that the Department of Defense had been reading my articles, and they thought that, you know, I'm a rational person and I'm not a BSer, and that I could be trusted, and they wanted to tell me to these events were happening and keep me posted so that I would publicize them. So that's what we began to do, and the meetings started to happen. There were meetings at the UN regarding the religious aspects of disclosure. There were meetings not at the UN in New York, but at a UN facility in Vienna, where the Committee for the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space had a meeting about disclosure. And that's when we found out at that time that the UN had appointed an ambassador for outer space affairs. And her name is Maslan Othman, which is kind of strange, because when you take her first initial in Maslan and Othman, what you get is Mothman, right? Odd. But I'll tell you this. In 2011, I met not only the ambassador for outer space affairs, Maslan Othman, I met a Mr. Propriotu, who was the chairman of the UN Committee for the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. And it was at the awarding of the Leonov Medal to Maslan Othman for her work in promoting peaceful uses of outer space. So in that meeting, I asked questions. And when I asked Mr. Propriotu about UN plans, contingency plans for encountering intelligent life in outer space, he was really beaming. He was ready to answer me. And because I'd met him before the conference and we talked at length about it and how much he loved outer space, and he'd been an astronaut, and how he still dreamed about going into outer space. So he was ready to answer me these questions. And I saw these shoulders go up and go down, you know, like a And it was Maslan Othman. She interrupted his answer. She said, let me tell you something right here. Nothing is going to happen at the United Nations regarding UFOs unless it is approved by three scientific organizations. The National Institute of Science, the National Institute of Aeronautics, and the National Institute of Astronautics. If those three scientific bodies do not approve it, nothing will get to the floor of the United Nations with regard to UFOs. And that settled it. So it's science and scientists who are the guardians, the gatekeepers of this UFO knowledge. And this dates back, Michael, this dates back to June 1947, because I have a letter in my possession. It's a 5-page letter written by Robert Oppenheimer and Albert Einstein, recommending to the Truman administration how to deal with a celestial race that has decided to settle on planet Earth. A race that has not requested permission to settle on planet Earth, a race that has decided to settle on planet Earth, and how to integrate their presence into world society. So they go through 5 pages of different jurisprudence and legalisms and how should it be done? Should countries each individually write individual treaties with these aliens, or should United Nations on behalf of all nations write a treaty, or should the United States on its own have a secret treaty with the aliens? And they actually chose that one. And I believe that's the day that Robert Oppenheimer and Albert Einstein betrayed the human race. They recommended to Truman that the United States sign a secret treaty with the aliens, giving them settlement rights and ranging rights, you know, the ability to go scrounging around doing abductions, and to trade human resources for technology, but that this treaty should be kept secret from the rest of the world, and from the American people. And as a result, this is what has happened.
Well, there's been a lot of people that have talked about these secret treaties, and they do seem to focus on the abduction phenomenon being something that emerged or grew because of these treaties, and of course, aliens working with the military in deep underground bases, and resources being given to aliens. So all of that's been going on for, as you said, going back even to the Truman administration. So this Richard Tillman experience, or this initiative in 2008 to 2009, was to kind of open the door to that, but it was sabotaged. Yeah. It was ended. So you want to explain how that initiative was sabotaged?
Okay, so Tillman's identity was secret. We used to call him Source A, or Squid. I call him Squid. And then these two self-styled ufologists wanted to find out who it was. So they went to great lengths to expose his identity. And they ultimately found some photographs that were taken at a costume party. With him dressed in a bikini and, playing around with ladies. And they used that to embarrass and discredit him. So as a result, having been exposed, he was removed from being Source A. But what people don't know is that the initiative continued, because I was contacted later on and asked to continue the disclosure movement. So Tillman paid a heavy price, being exposed by two, goofus and doofus is what I call them. They just were looking for some mischief, and they put us 10 years behind in disclosure. The other things that did come out of this is I discovered the secret language that the UN uses. If you write to the UN about UFOs, they'll say they have nothing, because they call them UHFOs, ultra high frequency objects. That is what the UN labels what we call flying saucers and UFOs. So this jargon is used to disguise and deceive people and to keep the secrets well hidden. But the U.S. Navy never stopped trying to force the disclosure. Unfortunately, when President Trump was a Navy asset, I would call him a Navy asset, he was asked to run for president by the U.S. Navy. And so in December of 2017, he released the Tic Tac video and allowed some of those Navy veterans, Fravor, Captain Fravor, and later Kevin Day, who was the radar man on the USS Princeton, and others to testify publicly. And now we're stuck in a lurch because, they all admit now it's true. Now the particulars are what they are hiding. And my take on it is that the U.S. government signed a treaty with the aliens, and clause number one of that treaty is that the alien presence should never be revealed to the world public or the American people. And if they reveal the alien presence, they will break that contract. And I think that the U.S. government is more afraid of the aliens than it is of the American people. And that's why they're trying to keep the lid, not only on that, but the $40 trillion that has been stolen from the American people and funneled into black projects, deep state projects, including reverse engineering that technology, and building the bases, the underground bases for the aliens. The tall whites are one of the principals of races with whom the U.S. government has a treaty. And I don't know if we ever told you this, Michael, but one of those meetings at the UN that Richard Thielman attended was hosted, or the principal speaker was a white alien ET. And he described to me how the aliens have an ability to shapeshift. They can change their appearance and appear human, but they cannot sustain it for a long time. It takes a lot of energy for them to generate this illusory image. And he said, and I said, what did he look like? He said, well, at first it looked like a tall white woman in professional corporate attire, white attire. And I said, yeah. And he said, but after about 30 minutes or 40 minutes, shape started to change. And I said, well, what does she look like? He says, it's really hard to describe, Robert. I would say, imagine the Pillsbury Doughboy, just this form, it was just white. And, you know, I go back to my childhood and the comic books and thinking about Casper the Friendly Ghost and how he was depicted and how similar Casper the Friendly Ghost is to some of the ETs that are part of modern UFO lore. So all of us were being conditioned over all those years. If people go to my Substack, the Morningstar Report on Substack, robertmorningstar.substack.com, I have a long string of UFO articles, and many of them have movies embedded in them from the 1950s, which in sum total reveal that the U.S. government and the British government knew all these things way back in the 1950s about the alien presence and their characteristics. Stranger from Venus, The Thing.
Yeah, you want to tell us a little bit, because I did go through your Substack website and look through that, some of the articles. And yeah, I had never seen this movie, Stranger from Venus, 1954, a low budget remake of the Hollywood movie The Day the Earth Stood Still. And it was like, wow, someone wanted the British public to understand what aliens were like. And it seemed that this was a positive faction, a positive group, you know, whether it was the Royal Navy, someone wanted to educate the Brits that aliens are real, they can walk amongst us, but they want us to grow up. So you want to tell us about this movie, The Stranger from Venus?
Well, I'm very gratified to tell you that I met Patricia Neal personally in 2004. There was a 50th anniversary showing of The Day the Earth Stood Still. And she's in both films. She's in The Day the Earth Stood Still, and she's a star in this one. So in Stranger from Venus, she encounters an extraterrestrial who's quite benevolent. And I think that this actually was a British leak of the Val Thor story. Val Thor has made his appearance in Washington, and this character reminds me more of Val Thor than anybody else. But the British, had to be British intelligence and Lord Mountbatten. Lord Mountbatten and King Prince Philip were very, very involved in ufology. As a matter of fact, a UFO landed on Broadlands in Lord Mountbatten's estate in 1955. same year that this movie was made. And apparently the aliens who came out and had a conversation with his gardener seemed to be this type of alien. They were humanoid. They said they actually spoke with something of a German accent. So there was a big push. Let me see. One of the producers, Desmond Leslie, was a royal. That's another thing that was revealed to me recently about this film. So they told about one benevolent faction of aliens who were here to work with mankind. And the demand was that we get rid of all nuclear weapons, which was proposed to President Eisenhower. But he realized that without nuclear weapons, we had no way of defending ourselves against hostile extraterrestrials, which we know existed. So The Stranger from Venus is a wonderful film. I found a pristine copy that's been colorized, and it tells a wonderful story, well worth seeing. And one of the things that The Stranger from Venus warns us about is the destabilization of planet Earth through nuclear testing. As he says, if you, after countless nuclear tests, if you alter the tilt of the Earth by less than 1/10 of 1 degree, that eventually will set the Earth spinning in another orbit. And it's a very, very cogent and intelligent explanation of how nuclear testing could be devastating, not just to the Earth, but to other planets, because he insinuated that if the Earth left its orbit, it might start colliding with other planetary bodies. So that is one. And then, of course, The Day the Earth Stood Still is another one. But that one, I look upon it differently nowadays. It's also a very big propaganda movie promoting the United Nations and global governance, because that was the main thrust of Mr. Carpenter, Klaatu's proposal: get rid of nuclear weapons or we're going to set these robots to get rid of you and join in the United Nations and make a treaty, and we will be watching you. So this, all these science fiction films had a measure of truth in them. The Thing is another one. The Thing talks about aliens who are predatory and live on plasma. They thrive on plasma, and human beings are primarily made of plasma. So each of these science fiction movies gave a hint, and it was to keep educating the public. And as a matter of fact, Michael, in 1965, I was watching Frank Edwards being interviewed on a program called The Alan Burke Show in New York. And he said that the CIA had informed him that they were very afraid of the reaction of the American people to the revelation of the alien presence because of the Orson Welles experience with War of the Worlds, the panic that ensued. And he said the CIA has a plan, seven-year plans, is 1965, seven-year plans to acclimatize the American public into the idea of the existence of extraterrestrials. And he predicted in 1965 that within 10 years, we would be seeing movies such as we had never seen before. New technology would be coming along, which would present the alien presence to the American people in a more positive way, rather than the monsters from outer space that was typical of 1950s and 60s science fiction. They would be presented as friendlier, less hostile aliens. And that's where we got Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and we got E.T., and on. But they're not all friendly, and that is the danger. I'm working on an article now called John Warned Us. Yes, Rob. Yes. Michael.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, that they're not all friendly, nor are they all evil. There's a mix, and we have to learn about it and be discerning about the choices. Now you did kind of mention this briefly, and I wanted to get you to talk a little bit more about it. You mentioned James Forrestal, the former former Navy Secretary and the first Secretary of Defense for the United States, and he was in favor of disclosure. Yes. His protege was John F. Kennedy. And when Kennedy became president, he actually wanted to continue the effort to disclose the truth. So you want to tell us, you know, what you think really happened in terms of JFK's assassination. Why was he eliminated?
Well, Michael, I want to congratulate you on a great book, Kennedy's Last Stand. As you recall, I was the one that broke the code of the burnt memo, because the code was in the burnt memo, which was leaked by Ufology, but nobody knew the code because the code was known only to JFK researchers. And I happened to be in both fields. So you and I had a three-hour conversation after I broke the code about wet works and who was Lancer and who's volunteer. And I have to commend you. You did a beautiful job in Kennedy's Last Stand, and I recommend it to everyone. President Kennedy knew about UFOs the day after the crash in Roswell because he was briefed on a flight between Washington and Boston by a staff member of the Secretary of the Air Force, who was also a good friend of Forrestal and a good friend of Kennedy. His name was Stuart Symington. Ironically, the governor of Arizona during the Phoenix Lights episode in 1997, his name Fife Symington. When I met Fife Symington in Washington at Leslie Keene's UFO press conference at the National Press Club, I said, "Are you the son of Fife Symington, of Stuart Symington?" He said, "No, he's my uncle." So this Air Force connection to UFOs and the cover-up, it runs very deep, and it's a family affair that goes on for generations. Now, Mr. Forrestal went down to Roswell, apparently had an encounter with the alien. He was exposed to the alien telepathy. And as a result, he went back to Washington and he felt that the American people had to be told about this event. At the same time, this is another part of another reason for his execution, was he was insistent that MJ-12 had to tell the American people. And at the same time, he was insistent that Truman should not recognize the state of Israel. And he started to be followed by what we would call men in black. He was attacked on the national media by Walter Winchell, who was the top radio columnist, newspaper man in the United States, along with another. And they took him by force into Bethesda Naval Hospital, which is where all of the atrocities were performed on the bodies of President Kennedy and Officer Tippit after the assassination of both. And it seems to me, having read the U.S. Navy Board of Inquiry report, well, the Willicutts investigation, that they were intentionally trying to drive him mad. They would take him up to the 17th floor where there was a television so he could watch the news in the afternoon. And what they would put on would be Walter Winchell and this other columnist just smearing his reputation, smearing him, particularly because of his resistance to recognizing the state of Israel. But there were no bed sheets. There were no bed sheets at Bethesda. The story is that he tried to tie bed sheets together and climb out the window of his room. He would never have fit through the window. He was actually thrown out the galley window. The galley window was a big giant screen door that opened like a door because there wasn't air conditioning in 1948-49. So they had a screen and a big wide swinging door. And Mr. Forrestal was thrown out of the galley window and landed on the second floor awning of the entrance. And when they found him, his bathrobe was garroted around his neck. Another strange thing is that they found a broken ashtray in his room. There was broken glass on the floor and broken glass under the bed and broken glass on the bed from a very heavy crystal ashtray. And the strange thing is that the orderly who was in charge of overseeing Mr. Forrestal was never called to testify. And he had a most unusual name. His name was Irvin Unwin. I-R-W-I-N, Unwin, U-N-W-I-N, Irvin Unwin. And that to me is a totally German name. And I believe it was a paperclip Nazi who was sent there to kill Forrestal. He said that he went up there and had looked for Mr. Forrestal and didn't find him. So he went around, he searched and he went to the galley and he went on the floor and he didn't find him. And then he went back into the room and he sat in the dark smoking cigarettes for about 5 minutes before he announced the disappearance of Mr. Forrestal. The other thing is that the Willicutts Board of Navy Board of Inquiry, U.S. Navy Board of Inquiry report on the hearing for Mr. Forrestal's untimely death is at Princeton University, and I stumbled upon it. And among the evidence are photographs of different things, photographs of the room, which was looking kind of crazy. You wanted to drive somebody mad, that would be the room to put him in. And then there is a photograph of a poem that he supposedly wrote, Ulysses by Alfred Lord Tennyson, written in pencil on brown piece paper. Doesn't look like his handwriting to handwriting experts, all to insinuate that it was a suicide. And the final thing that really caught my eye was there was a Rolodex of all the people who visited Bethesda that night. And there's a time, you sign in the time. We've all done it now. We go to hospitals or security-related places. You sign in the timesheet, the time you've gotten in, the time you left. So I came across one that said a time of 24:50. And I looked at that. I said, that's impossible. There is no 24:50 time in the military. Military time goes from 0000 midnight to 2400 midnight PM. And so the nurse apparently was forced to rewrite all the cards and she left a hint. She changed the time of the initial discovery of Mr. Forrestal's disappearance, which should have been 0050 or 10:1. And she wrote in 2450, a time that doesn't exist in the military. So it's clear to me that Mr. Forrestal, may he rest in peace, was assassinated to keep the secret of the UFOs very deeply secret and to hide the existence of MJ-12 from the American people.
And of course, he was a formative influence on President Kennedy, and President Kennedy met a similar fate when he was pushing, advocating for disclosure. Now, one of the things that I found very interesting in the connection between the Forrestal assassination and the Kennedy assassination is that one of the people that visited James Forrestal while he was in the Bethesda Medical Center was Congressman Lyndon Johnson, who he was at the time a congressman rather than a senator. And he visited, and he was one of the people that MJ-12 had sent in to pressure Forrestal to not talk about UFOs, not propose disclosure. And when Forrestal refused to cooperate, Johnson was involved in the hit because that's his forte. He was a hitman. This is something that others have talked about, that Johnson was a hitman, that the Majestic 12 people would use, and that these people like him, when they perform such jobs, they get promoted. So he got promoted, became a senator, and then he eventually ends up being Kennedy's vice president. And he was put there to kind of babysit Kennedy to make sure Kennedy didn't talk about the UFO issue. And of course, Kennedy really did push for the UFO issue. And Johnson was...
You're absolutely right. And Johnson?
Yeah, Roger Stone identifies Lyndon Johnson's involvement in all of that.
Oh, well, he did a great job with his book. I bought two copies of it, as a matter of fact. Johnson was a notorious gangster, to put it mildly. But he also ascended very quickly in the Outer Space Committee in the 1950s when he finally got to the Senate. He was the chairman of the Committee on Outer Space Affairs. So he was privy to the UFO secret throughout his time in the Senate. The other thing is that Johnson was enlisted by the CIA. This is something I haven't shared with you, Michael, but last year we found the man who killed President Kennedy, James Files, who was a CIA operative embedded with the Chicago Mafia. And we found the files maintained by the CIA. The director of clandestine operations, Robert Trumbull Crowley, was at every planning session for the assassination, and he kept copious notes and a list of all the people who attended. And I have those files, and it reveals that the Department of Defense, the CIA, the Deep State, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all got together and held a trial of President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy in absentia, a star chamber, and condemned them to death for high treason. And they then planned the execution of President Kennedy in a public execution in Dallas. And a month after the assassination, exactly 1 month, December 22nd, 1963, they had an after action briefing to discuss how the operation had gone and how it was going as far as the cover-up was concerned. And they said that Lyndon Johnson had been told about the plot beforehand, that they assassinated President Kennedy in front of Lyndon Johnson so that he would know that if he did not go along, the same thing would happen to him. They also acknowledged that what they were doing was illegal. They claim that going through the natural constitutional procedures of impeachment and in trial in the Senate would take too long, and that they had to be removed immediately. And so they had to use extra legal methods to conduct this public execution. Many, many more things are revealed in the zipper files. As I said, they were maintained and written by the director of clandestine operations, Robert Trumbull Crowley. And on his deathbed, he handed over these files to a writer named Gregory Douglas, who wrote a book called Regicide. That was published around 2003. Apparently, all copies of Regicide were bought up and taken off the shelves in the United States. But through the good graces of my partner, Jim Scott, I got a copy of it. And it describes not only the Chicago Mafia element of the assassination, but also the French Corsican Mafia assassins who were sent there. And then were they themselves assassinated in the aftermath. I would like to tell you and the American people, world people who are listening, that one of the principal causes of the Vietnam War was to assure France that they would be able to continue the drug running operations that they had been running in Indochina since World War II. And that was that the Golden Triangle is a landlocked area, and France begged the U.S. government not to pull out of Vietnam because Vietnam was essential to the drug trade. Without Vietnam's rivers, the French could not export the drugs from the Golden Triangle. They had to smuggle them through the rivers of Vietnam to the coasts where they could be shipped to the United States and to Cuba for processing and dissemination. So in 1967, Charles de Gaulle went to Washington and he met with the director of Central Intelligence Agency and again begged them not to withdraw from Vietnam. And that in return for holding on to Vietnam, facilitating the French connection, drug trade, they would split the profits of that drug trade 50-50 with the CIA. And that's where the black funding, the dark money, has been funding illicit operations for the CIA and for the French government since 1967 until actually the United States had to withdraw. But I'm sure that even until today, the rivers of Vietnam are still being used for drug trafficking.
Well, I want to cover. I want to start to bring this interview to a close. So I just want to kind of finish up on the current state of UFO disclosure. Now, we had, of course, and you already mentioned 2017, the release of those Navy videos, and that's again another example of the Navy wanting to push UFO disclosure. They want the truth to come out. So what do you think of this David Grush? I think you already mentioned him, but what do you think of his revelations? I mean, is this another example of the Navy wanting this information to come out, that people like him are being encouraged to talk about these classified programs involving crashed UFOs, reverse engineering, and the existence of non-human intelligence?
Well, yes, of course, the Navy supports David Grush, but he is a disgruntled U.S. Air Force officer who was threatened, and that's the reason. He didn't like his life being threatened for talking about what he was ordered to investigate. So I do believe him. I believe and I know that we have photographs of the alien bodies. I have a photograph myself of six alien bodies, crash recovered alien bodies. They look like tall whites. They have very unusual features. Well, I would say mostly their feet. They have feet that have three big toes with an overdeveloped ball of the foot. They're very, very pale white, but they do have red blood because the skin that's been peeled off or scoured does show red blood under them. So Mr. Grush is telling the truth, and I support him. He's a very courageous man. And as you saw immediately afterwards, the Mockingbird media started to smear him, bringing out things about his divorce and his wife and psychiatric sessions that he had to have. That's all distraction. The man is telling the truth. I respect him, and I hope that we will hear more from him. The other problem is that, again, we said there's a faction that wants disclosure, but then let me just put it plainly. The criminals don't want disclosure. The criminals being the ones who ran these unconstitutional black projects, who have built the U.S. taxpayer for over $40 trillion to reverse engineer these craft and put them in the hands of the military industrial corporate complex, which has now gone beyond nation. It's gone supranational. It's gone toward the idea of we're so powerful that we are the ones who should be conducting global governance. And that's what we and the American people are facing. A coup d'etat on the global scale and the destruction of the United States government, the United States Republic, the Constitutional Republic, is the last stumbling block of their plans to institute global communist government.
So, are you optimistic? Are you optimistic or pessimistic about what the next 5 years are going to bring?
I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic that you, Michael, and other people like you and alternate media, especially the UFO community, has become more and more important, going from a fringe group and a ridiculed group of conspiracy theorists who have now been proven to have known the truth all the time and told the truth for the last 80 years. So we command a lot of respect now. There's no giggling, there's no ridicule on television when they interview somebody. As you recall, throughout the 90s, they always had to bring up Little Green Man and start twittering around and goofing on a person's sanity. Now that's gone. UFOs are real, it has been revealed. The problem is the political problem that these people who have kept the secret and looted the U.S. Treasury and stolen what they reverse engineered face liabilities, and they're fighting tooth and claw for their own self-preservation. But they can just go to hell as far as I'm concerned, right? The truth is out, and you can't put the genie back in the bottle. President Kennedy was killed precisely. He was on his way to speak at 1 o'clock in the afternoon at the Dallas Trademark, and the CIA found out that he had some cards with a secret expose of the Roswell UFO crash and the alien presence. And that's why they had to kill him. If he had gotten to the Trademark and spoken at 1 o'clock, he was going to reveal the alien presence and the reverse engineering of the Roswell craft. They did all of that to kill the messenger. But on December 22nd, the 60th anniversary of their after action briefing, I went on coast to coast and I read John F. Kennedy's words to a nationwide audience. And those words are resonating. People know the truth and it is going to free us. And we have to see that this criminal cabal that's installed itself in Washington, in every level of government, you know, the executive, the judicial, hopefully not the judicial, they got saved when President Trump appointed some really good judges. But the federal judiciary, where these kangaroo court martials of President Trump are going on, you can see how corrupt they are. But the battle is on, but I am optimistic. I don't doubt for a second that the American people have awakened and that more and more of them are awakening every day through the alternate media, which means Michael Sala, the Morningstar Report, hundreds of writers on Substack, Joe Rogan, all of us. We're now more popular than CNN. Their audiences are dwindling. Less than 300,000 people really tune into CNN at night now. And Tucker Carlson went from 3.5 million people listening to his show and then getting fired, and now he's got 12 million people. So Twitter, and I thank Elon Musk for making Twitter a free speech platform again as well. Yeah, no, so I'm very optimistic that we are going to see things through.
So where do people go, Robert, if they want to read your articles or get in touch with you?
Oh, very simple. My name, robertmorningstar.substack.com. And I highly encourage you to go to the recent article, which deals with astronaut Buzz Aldrin leaked a photograph a month ago, a signed photograph that I found on his Twitter account. And I saw a pile of debris in front of a lunar cave. And when I investigated it, it's a crash site with a lot of mechanical parts, pieces, wheels, and pulleys and drive shafts and cables. It's not lunar material. So I think that Buzz Aldrin, his soul wants to tell the truth too. And all of us want to hear the truth. So robertmorningstar.substack.com. You can write to me at robert.morningstar@gmail.com. And I'd like to announce that next month in May, going to be running an online seminar, 4 weeks long, and I'm calling it MJ13, because those of you who take that course will know as much as a 13th member of MJ12. That's my code name for myself. I call myself MJ13. So there's going to be an MJ13 UFO seminar, which I will announce. It'll be a Zoom meeting, and there will be a price. I have to charge because I'm at the end of my tether, folks. I need your help. I've never made a penny on any of this, and I've funded radio shows, videos, movies, and so I do need your financial support. And you can do it through Global Peace Media. It's a tax-exempt organization with whom I'm partnered. You can find the links at robertmorningstar.substack.com. And I want to thank Michael Sala for this interview and for all the great work you've done for all those years, Michael. You know, we've been through the thick and the thin, and we did our best, and we're still here delivering the truth about it.
Yes, we are still here. We specialize in outliving our enemies, so that's a very positive thing. So I want to thank you, Robert, for being on Exopolitics today, and I wish you all the best with your future writing and with your Zoom seminar on becoming MJ, how people can become an MJ13. So I look forward to that. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.